Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. A new Islamic State affiliate claimed responsibility Thursday for killing 15 people in a suicide bombing at a Saudi mosque used by security forces. The Hejaz province of the Islamic State said it carried out the attack. It made the claim in a Twitter statement hours after a suicide bomber detonated the explosive as worshippers prayed at the mosque in the southern city of Abha. 12 of those killed were trainees with the country's Special Weapons and Tactics Unit, tasked with domestic security, while three others were workers at the compound. Seven other people were injured in the blast. Egypt has opened a major expansion of the Suez Canal that President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has billed as an historic achievement needed to boost the country's ailing economy after years of unrest. At an elaborate ceremony in the canal city of Ismailia, the president addressed the terrorist threat surrounding the project. "Work did not take place in normal circumstances, and these circumstances still exist, and we are fighting them, and we will defeat them," Mr. el-Sisi said, after signing an order allowing ships to cross the new stretch of waterway. The $8.5 billion extension involved digging and dredging 72 of the 193-kilometer canal. Secretary of State John Kerry says the U.S. and Russia have reached a deal on a U.N. Security Council resolution that aims to identify those who carried out chemical weapons attacks in Syria. The resolution, which could be voted on as early as this week, would create a panel to investigate who is responsible for a series of chemical weapons attacks during the Syrian civil war. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry directly called on China Thursday to stop building artificial islands in the South China Sea and halt construction efforts on disputed lands. During a regional forum of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Malaysia this week, diplomats again struggled to agree on a joint statement on the territorial dispute. Kerry called it essential to maintain freedom of navigation and overflight in the region.
"I reiterated America's strong support for freedom of navigation, overflight, and other lawful uses of the sea. These rights, I would remind everybody, are universal rights, and they must be respected by every nation, large and small."
Kerry urged the countries to commit to stop the construction and militarization of features in the region to lower tensions. Kerry told reporters the United States has a strong interest in the South China Sea and the way the disputes are addressed. Malaysia's transport minister says additional airplane parts have been located in, on Reunion Island in the Indian Ocean, where a piece of the wing from the missing Malaysian jetliner was recovered last week. Liao Tiang Lai says the newly found parts include seat cushions, window panes, and other debris. But while he concluded the items are plane debris, could not state with certainty they belong to Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. Experts in Paris, where the part was taken for analysis, are not yet ready to say for sure that what was found on the French territory is part of the vanished plane. Myanmar's president has called for the evacuation of low-lying areas in the country's Irrawaddy Delta region as the rivers reached high levels and threatened to breach embankments. About 6.2 million people, 12% of Myanmar's population, live in the region. The widespread floods that were triggered last week by heavy monsoon rains have killed 81 people, according to the Ministry of Social Welfare, Relief and Resettlement. The United States has announced an aid package to help flood victims in Myanmar. France's defense minister announced Thursday that his government reached agreement with Russia to cancel the contract for the sale of two Mistral-class warships. Jean-Yves Le Drian said France would fully reimburse what Russia had already paid for the contract without mentioning the specific amount. Meanwhile, Russia marked the one-year anniversary of its ban on Western agricultural products Thursday. President Vladimir Putin had ordered the destruction of illegal imports to enforce the ban amid continuing tensions with the West because of the Ukrainian crisis. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, the report we've just published describes cases of arbitrary arrest, ill treatment and torture in particularly outside the capital, Bujumbura. So we carried out research in four provinces, as well as in the capital.
That's Human Rights Watch researcher Karina Tertsakian commenting on the findings of a new report on Burundi. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Nigeria today began repatriating about 12,000 refugees from Cameroon who had fled Boko Haram violence in recent years.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Jonah Haskell sitting in for Sunny, music from Algeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Nigeria today began repatriating about 12,000 refugees from Cameroon who had fled Boko Haram violence in recent years. A spokesman for Nigeria's National Emergency Management Agency says more than 1,000 refugees already have been taken to Mubi Town in Nigeria's Adamawa State. The remaining refugees will be brought back to Nigeria within the next several days. Cameroon expelled almost 3,000 Nigerians last weekend after suicide bombers attacked mosques and towns. Some of Nigeria's refugees were believed to be Boko Haram rebels.
The recent assassination of Burundi's former security chief and the attempted assassination of a prominent human rights leader underscores the growing tension in the country. But a new report by Human Rights Watch says there's also been a spate of arbitrary arrests and torture since April. That's when violence first erupted after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. HRW says officials accuse many of the mostly young men arrested of trying to leave the country and planning to join an armed rebellion. Karina Tertsakian is the Human Rights Watch senior researcher on Burundi. From London, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about insecurity in the country.
Well, the report we've just published describes cases of arbitrary arrest, ill treatment and torture in particularly outside the capital, Bujumbura. So we carried out research in four provinces, as well as in the capital, and we documented more than 148 cases of arrests, torture or ill treatment, mostly by the intelligence services and by members of the Youth League of the ruling party, as well as some policemen. Most of these cases occurred in June and July, but some of them go back to April.
What caused the Human Rights Watch to look outside of Bujumbura for these violations?
International attention was very much focused on events in the capital. This was quite understandable because that was where most of the very dramatic incidents were occurring. But we also discovered that there were many abuses going on in other parts of the country. And these abuses have largely gone unreported because for the last couple of months, the government have prevented the independent private radio stations from broadcasting. So since April, May, the country's main private radios, which are really the main source of information on events outside the capital, have been off the air. This has meant that a lot of these very serious incidents have simply gone unnoticed.
Now, we've been hearing more and more reports of youth being involved in violent acts. What can you tell us?
Well, indeed, we documented many cases of attacks by the youth who are known as the Imbonerakure. These are members of the Youth League of the ruling party. This is not a new phenomenon, I should say. The Imbonerakure have been used by the ruling party to target their suspected opponents. We saw the same thing, in fact, around the last elections in 2010, and it's continued ever since. So the kinds of abuses that we've documented include arrests, which in themselves are illegal because members of the Youth League have no legal powers of arrest, so they're not allowed to arrest people. Nevertheless, they have been arresting people. They've been beating them up severely and then often handing them over to the intelligence services, where members of the intelligence services are then beating them again and sometimes even torturing them.
Now, I see that the national president of the Youth League, Dennis Carrera, has told Human Rights Watch in a meeting that he was not aware of these allegations, and he is quoted as saying, "I'm against all violence. I can't tolerate it. People who do it," he says, "should be tried and punished in accordance with the law." Can you tell us about the meeting you had with him?
Yes, well, this is not the first meeting we've had with him, but this time he did take a clear position against the violence and abuses, which is obviously a positive thing. He didn't say he wasn't aware of the allegations in general. He said he wasn't aware of each of the individual allegations that we brought to his attention. But he quite rightly said that the members of the Youth League who carry out abuses should be tried and punished in accordance with the law. Now, unfortunately, it seems that that position is completely ignored by many other authorities. What is really striking in almost all the cases that we've documented is that the people responsible for these abuses are not brought to justice. And indeed, one of the issues we're drawing attention to now is the way that the justice system in Burundi, which already was very weak, is now practically broken, I would say. There are decisions made by judicial authorities that are then torn apart or overruled by members of the government, by members of the intelligence services who are dictating who should be detained for how long, and the justice system is currently unable to function in an independent way.
Well, as you know, just in the recent days, there was the assassination of the former intelligence chief and the attempted assassination of a high-profile human rights leader. What is Human Rights Watch's reaction to those?
Well, we're extremely shocked by these two incidents, blatant acts of violence against high-profile individuals. The Burundian authorities should immediately carry out thorough investigations to find out who was responsible for these two attacks and bring those responsible to justice. In the case of Pierre Claver Bonima, the country's leading human rights activist, we're particularly worried about his security and his protection. He's still in hospital, slowly recovering from his injuries, but we're calling on the Burundian government to make sure that nothing happens to him. Our other great fear, of course, is that these two attacks could lead to further violence.
Karina Tertasakian is the Human Rights Watch senior researcher on Burundi from London. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Rescuers on the Mediterranean hold out hope that some of an estimated 200 migrants missing from a capsized fishing boat may still be alive on today's calm, warm waters. Their 20-meter-long boat sank yesterday as an Irish naval vessel approached. Officials say when passengers on deck saw the Irish vessel, they rushed to one side, causing the fishing boat to overturn and sink. Helicopters and ships from Italy, Ireland, and Doctors Without Borders rescued 367 people within hours and recovered 35 drowning victims. Vessels continue the search through Wednesday night and into today.
And Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi opened a 72-kilometer extension of the Suez Canal today with great fanfare and plenty of security. The $8.5 billion canal addition is expected to boost the national economy, troubled by years of political chaos. Economists and shipping analysts question whether there is sufficient traffic and east-west trade to meet the ambitious revenue targets.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, together with the governments of Kenya and Somalia, is stepping up efforts to repatriate greater numbers of Somali refugees from Kenya. The UNHCR says the arrival yesterday at Mogadishu International Airport of 116 Somali refugees from Dadaab in northeastern Kenya marks a first step in this expanded voluntary return process. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
An agreement by a tripartite commission composed of the UNHCR, Kenya, and Somalia envisions the voluntary repatriation of some 425,000 Somali refugees from Kenya over a five-year period. Most of the refugees, 330,000, are living in Dadaab, the largest refugee settlement in the world. Many of the refugees have been there since the 1990s and have given birth to children who have never been to Somalia. The return of the 116 Somali refugees follows a pilot repatriation program begun in December, which has successfully returned 3,000 refugees to the relatively safe districts of Luke, Baidoa, and Kismayo. UNHCR spokeswoman Karen de Groot tells VOA the refugees are receiving some money, food, seeds, and other assistance. But she acknowledges the situation in Somalia is far from ideal.
Its socioeconomic situation is very, very difficult, and the situation is not there yet for loads and loads of people to return at this moment. That is, the security situation in Somalia it remains precarious. That's why we are targeting the returns to specific areas where we feel that there's more stability, and we hope with development projects and with the return of refugees, these areas of stability may grow and counter that.
Under the new tripartite commission agreement, de Groot says these areas have been increased to 9 districts in south-central regions of Somalia. She says refugees who voluntarily return there and to areas in Somaliland and Puntland will receive assistance to help them integrate in their new lives. She says one of the reasons some refugees want to return to their homes of origin is that life in the Dadaab refugee camp is becoming more difficult. She says aid agencies such as the World Food Program, or WFP, are running out of money and have to cut back on their assistance.
WFP has just announced that it's going to reduce, or has actually already reduced, its food rations with 30%. Refugees in the camps are not allowed to leave the camps, so it's definitely not a good living situation, and there's very little hope for the future. So these are conditions that might influence them to go back.
De Groot says plans are underway to hold a pledging conference, possibly in October, to raise money for development projects in Somalia. The UNHCR spokeswoman says it is crucial to rebuild the country's roads, clinics, schools, and other infrastructure to ensure that refugee returns are sustainable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up on 18 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Well, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell yesterday praised the formation of a new coalition of conservation, corporate, media, and nonprofit leaders to work closely with the U.S. government to combat wildlife trafficking in the U.S. and abroad. The new U.S. Wildlife Trafficking Alliance fulfills one of the directives of the National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking. The African Wildlife Foundation, AWF, says efforts to stop poaching and trade of wildlife must move beyond relying solely on governments to provide solutions. Kathleen Garrigan is the media relations manager for AWF. She says the new alliance will work to stop the poaching and trafficking of wild animals.
I think what we have right now is sort of two entities working on it. You have the NGO or conservation entities, and then you have the government sort of addressing it from their side, from the legal side of things. I think one of the critical pieces that's missing in that is the private sector. And there's still a real knowledge deficit in the United States about the crisis. As much as we in the conservation community and sometimes in the media know about it, I think of your average citizen, probably it's still not really on their radar. So by bringing in some of these private sector partners into the fold, you know, the Amazons, the Facebooks, Google, we're really hoping to utilize their platforms, their resources, their perspective on how you mobilize and broadcast messages across the U.S. to sort of fill that knowledge gap and, you know, elevate the profile of this issue across the United States. And I think that's one of the key components of this that we're really looking to address with the alliance. And once we've sort of elevated the profile of this issue and we've raised awareness, I think therein lies sort of checking off one of the other objectives of the alliance, which is to reduce demand for wildlife products here in the U.S. Again, because many people don't know about the poaching crisis in Africa, because they don't connect what's going on in Africa with products that are for sale here in the U.S., they unwittingly could be contributing to the problem.
Yes, and this touches on one of the questions I was going to ask you, too, in terms of using technology and social media to stop trafficking and poaching. So basically, you're saying this will be used in terms of bringing awareness to people?
Exactly. And Facebook is already engaging with the alliance. They're already looking at how they can use, for example, their platform to raise awareness about wildlife trafficking here in the United States and abroad. We only have so many bullhorns in the conservation community, and the government has so many channels they use to get out the word about what's going on. But certainly when you bring in some of these big industry players like Facebook, like Amazon, like eBay, like Google, they have a much broader reach, and we really need to be able to use that reach to get the message out.
And we also saw how effective social media can be with the recent incident in Zimbabwe with the trophy hunting, the shooting of the lion Cecil, and how social media information was passed along through that before it even came to the mass media, the television and radio stations. Looking at the alliance itself, how will trophy hunting be affected by the alliance, or will it, since it is considered a legal type of activity?
The alliance is the coalition that's been designed to address wildlife trafficking, which is quite different from, as you pointed out, the legal hunting that's going on. You know, I think the two issues sometimes get a little bit conflated, and there's certainly different dynamics and drivers behind each of these different industries. It's primarily focused on wildlife trafficking and stopping the trafficking of ivory, rhino horn, pangolin scales, live great apes across international and national boundaries. You know, as we saw with Cecil, I mean, that is the power of social media right there. You know, a lot of people were not aware of trophy hunting in Africa. They were not aware that this industry, there were certain abuses in this industry. And what we saw with Cecil, thanks in large part to social media and the media, is this sort of snowball effect. You know, it was like a trickle at first with people starting to learn about what was happening, and then it just exploded into this outpouring of support and, in some cases, outrage. That's the kind of spotlight we want to show on wildlife trafficking. We feel like there's great positive momentum right now, and we're reaching a tipping point towards lots of people understanding what's going on, but we just really need the surge to inundate the American public with the wildlife trafficking crisis and the poaching so that we sort of capitalize on the moment that's happening right now. And I would just add, with regard to other wildlife markets, certainly big ivory markets like in China, there are public awareness, demand reduction campaigns, there are very concerted efforts to elevate the profile of this issue in those countries. You just don't see a similar awareness campaign happening in the U.S. It needs to happen here as well.
That was Kathleen Garrigan, Media Relations Manager for AWF. She spoke with me from Washington.
In New York City, on Lower Manhattan Island, lie 2.5 hectares of land that represent brutal early American history. It's where many Africans are buried, Africans who were slaves in homes, factories, and the city's burgeoning port. They were among untold numbers of Africans forcibly taken from their homelands and brought to the New World in chains. For hundreds of years, they were simply forgotten. That changed in 1991 when the bones of over 400 people were unearthed during construction of a federal office building. A portion of the burial ground was set aside as a monument to the slaves. It is now the African Burial Ground National Monument. VOA's Adam Phillips went to the memorial and spoke to some of its visitors.
On a quiet Lower Manhattan street, a stream of water symbolizing the Atlantic Ocean flows alongside a narrow boat-like structure, an echo of the ships that made their way to the New World, heavy laden with human cargo. Nearby, Juanita Jones, an elderly African-American, fixes her gaze on grassy mounds. They are the main visible reminder of the vast 17th and 18th century Negro burial ground, now the African Burial Ground National Monument.
Most of these are young people because they didn't live to be so long, because they were the ones that are hard working. You're looking down here, you see babies, infant, newborns, and all that stuff. Young people are dying like that. It's very bad.
Like Ms. Jones, Mary Palmer is an African-American, born in Harlem, further north in Manhattan. She has just emerged from within the slave ship structure.
When I walked through, I felt like my heart started jumping because it's like I'm feeling the souls coming up to me. Like your cousin or somebody you never saw before comes up to you, and then they say, oh, hi, they touch you and you feel something. It stirs your inner self. That's what it felt like. Somebody that was part of my family, you know, might have been. They touched me inside and shook me a little bit. So I had to lean back and hold on. You know, it was very heart-wrenching, kind of scary.
Michael Jiwa and his family are visiting New York from Nigeria. He has a sense that some of the people buried may be his ancestors and feels that his visit has offered him a bit of closure.
It's a beautiful thing to come and see where your ancestors were buried. At least, you, even though you don't see them in life, at least you know where they're buried. And like that gives you a kind of joy, like at least. Because like you always want to know where you came from, like where you originated from. If you don't know your origin, like people see you like an outcast, like nobody.
Meanwhile, Billy Williams of the Bronx, Manhattan's neighboring borough to the north, stands by the mounds, shaking his head.
I have never been much into genealogy, but I do know that I have some African ancestry. And I wonder if I was just standing on a few, you know, to look at a piece of cement that says 353 kids are buried under that is heart-wrenching to anyone. It's beyond my verbal description, you know, what I feel. The historical tragedies that have taken place over time. I'm going to make it a point to bring my grandchildren down here so they can see this important part of our history.
For Shirley Moultrie, the clean, elegant feel of the monument misrepresents the actual history of African slavery in New York, when cruelty and misery were part of everyday life.
It makes it seem like everything is okay. They just buried here. But they chained us, they beat us until we didn't even know our name. They beat us until we said massa. We was almost like animals. Whatever they say do, we did. It was like we didn't even know how to think because we were scared of the whip. We was taught sometime to hate ourselves. I think it's very sad.
Moultrie says that for African Americans, the past continues in the present, both in the racist ways they're often treated and in their own attitudes toward others.
And I think that sometime some blacks do have the hatred for others because of this. And once we know why and how we was treated, then we can say, oh, that's why we react to certain things this way. This is why the white man might tell us something and we say, yes, sir, no, sir, because we don't know any better, you know? I wasn't raised to be prejudiced, but I'm standoffish from them, whites, yeah, Caucasians, whatever you want to call them. But we have to learn to live beyond that.
As visitors to this place have learned, and as recent headlines have made clear, getting beyond the past can be a long, difficult, and painful ordeal. The creators of the African Burial Mound Monument hope this site can be a place to begin to discover, remember, and ultimately to heal that legacy. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. Thank you.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. An Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi opened a 22-mile-long extension of the Suez Canal today with great fanfare and plenty of security. Coming up, we'll have music from Algeria, and in our feature segment, fistula patients in South Sudan are shunned by their communities. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhid, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. It's time now for the sunny side of sports with Jonah Haskell sitting in this week for Sunny Young. Hello, Jonah.
Hello, Kim.
Well, I understand the FIFA rankings tops your sports report today.
Yes, it does. We'll begin today with the new August FIFA rankings that were released on Thursday. Remaining in the top spot for the second straight month are the Albiceleste of Argentina. Coming in number two is Eden Hazard's Belgium, which switched spots with world champion Germany, who fell to third. James Rodriguez's Colombia and the Seleção of Brazil round out the top five, while the rest of the top ten are, in order, Portugal, Romania, England, Wales, and Chile. The 2010 World Cup winners, Spain, came in at 11th, while the Netherlands fell all the way to 12th, from 5th place last month. The first African team in the rankings is Algeria, who came in at 19th, while Ivory Coast and Ghana are close behind at 21 and 27, respectively. Gold Cup winner Mexico is one spot ahead of Ghana in 26th place, while the United States rose two spots to take 29th. The biggest mover of the month was Serbia, who fell a full 23 spots to 66th, while the biggest riser was surprising Gold Cup runner-up Jamaica, who rose a total of 21 spots to 55th. The next set of FIFA rankings will be released on September 3rd, 2015.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
Staying with football now, the final of the Audi Cup was played on Wednesday afternoon between Bayern Munich and Real Madrid. The hard-fought match was scoreless for most of regulation time, but 2 minutes before the final whistle, Douglas Costa of Bayern curled the ball into the box, and Robert Lewandowski was there to redirect it into the net. It was to be the game's only goal, and Bayern Munich won 1-0 to take home the Audi Cup for the third time and second consecutively. After the game, Bayern boss Pep Guardiola spoke about how his team played and about their readiness for the season.
Today, the people in Munich are satisfied, but maybe that will change tomorrow. It's the same as it was against Wolfsburg. We played well then, and 8 or 9 minutes before the end, there was a goal. Wolfsburg, we lost on penalties, but today we won. Both times we played against great squads. We lost the Super Cup, but we are ready. The players have shown their qualities and their mentality is spot on. The important thing now is that we keep our focus on the present It doesn't matter what we've done in the past.
Real Madrid did not play their best game, as Bayern was able to control possession for most of the match and had several great chances at goal. This may be due to the fact that Madrid was not playing its top players. Cristiano Ronaldo was not even in Munich with the team, while Gareth Bale, Rafael Varane, and Danilo did not play at all. At a press conference after the match, Real Madrid coach Rafa Benitez offered his thoughts on the tournament and an explanation for sitting his stars.
It's difficult to say, but I think on the whole it was a positive experience for our younger players, and also because of the work we did as a team. That said, I'm sad about the defeat. Bayern have an extra gear above us right now.
Una marcha más que nosotros ahora mismo. Y en el caso de Bale, como en el caso de Danilo, de Varane, no queríamos arriesgar porque ayer hicieron.
We didn't want to risk things with Gareth Bale, Danilo, or Varane because they did a lot of work yesterday.
Pero los jugadores que jugaron ayer.
You put Danilo on to have a bit more pace on the right. It wasn't advisable to pick the players who featured yesterday. The main thing is that the players keep working hard whilst also protecting the squad.
The third place game at the Audi Cup was not as tight an affair, as Tottenham Hotspur defeated AC Milan 2-0. The scoring began in the 8th minute when Tottenham midfielder Nasser Chadli ripped a left-footed shot from outside the box, and Milan keeper Christian Abbiati had no chance to save it, making the score 1-0 for Tottenham. Thomas Carroll would seal the game for the North Londoners in the 71st minute when he got on the end of a through ball into the box and curled the ball off the far post and in to make it 2-0. That would be the final score of the game, with Tottenham claiming third place in Munich. Despite not winning the competition, Spurs manager Mauricio Pochettino says that the Audi Cup was important for his team.
I think that this is important for us to compete. I think the experience is maybe it's a short time. We have to recover it for Manchester. But I think it's, this type of game for us is very, very important because we have a very young squad and you need to feel on the pitch when you play with a top player like Gareth Bale, Isco, Sergio Ramos and company. And you need to improve and to take the experience and try to do better your game and improve your performance.
The Premier League season begins for Pochettino and the Spurs very soon, on Saturday to be exact. Audi Cup champions Bayern Munich begin the Bundesliga on Friday, while Real Madrid and AC Milan begin their domestic seasons next week. I get knocked down. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma joins us now from Johannesburg, South Africa, and I believe he starts off with basketball news.
Hosts Mali pipped Egypt 77-75 at the Africa Under-16 Basketball Championships in Bamako on Tuesday night. Algeria outplayed Equatorial Guinea 90-48. Nigeria edged Rwanda 72-68. Angola dismissed Tunisia 84-69. And South Africa beat Morocco 73-68. Today, Thursday, in quarterfinal action, Mali engage Morocco. Egypt play Tunisia. Algeria tackle South Africa. And Angola meet Nigeria. In football, African champions Mali, Guinea, Nigeria, and South Africa get to know their opponents in the preliminary round when the draws for the 2015 FIFA Under-17 World Cup takes place in Santiago, Chile today, Thursday. In netball, Malawi plays South Africa as Uganda encounter tournament debutants Zambia at the start of the 2015 Netball World Cup in Sydney, Australia, tomorrow, Friday. On Saturday, Uganda play Fiji, South Africa engage Singapore, Malawi tackle Sri Lanka, and Zambia challenge Wales. On Sunday, Malawi play Singapore, Zambia face Sri Lanka as Uganda encounter Wales. Finally, in volleyball, Tunisia play Iran in their opening match at the second World Men's Under-23 Volleyball Championships, starting in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, on the 24th of August. According to the draws in Dubai, Tunisia will also face Cuba, Mexico, Russia, and Turkey in the other Group B encounters. Meanwhile, Egypt is drawn in Group A with Argentina, Brazil, Italy, South Korea, and hosts a United Arab Emirates.
Thank you, Mark. Now, moving on to aquatics, the FINA World Aquatics Championships are underway in Kazan, Russia, and on Wednesday, several important swimming events took place. In the semifinals of the men's 100-meter freestyle, Australia's Cameron McAvoy earned the top seed in the final by posting a time of 47.94 seconds, making him the only swimmer to post a time under 48 seconds. China's Ning Shetao was second, while Argentina's Federico Grabich came in third. The men's 200-meter butterfly final also took place Wednesday, and it was Hungary's Laszlo Seh who won the gold, narrowly defeating 2013's winner, South African Chad Liklos. Jan Switkowski of Poland took the bronze. And the men's 50-meter breaststroke finals featured a very impressive showing from Great Britain's Adam Peaty. In the semifinal race earlier, Peaty had broken the world record and set a new time of 26.42 seconds. In the final, Peaty was not able to break his own record, but barely, as he recorded the second fastest time ever, finishing in 26.51 seconds to win the gold. Defending champion Cameron van der Berg of South Africa came in second, just ahead of the USA's Kevin Cordes. Sun Yang of China won the gold in the men's 800-meter freestyle, repeating his victory from the last World Aquatics Championships in 2013, and beating out Italian Gregorio Baltrinieri and Australian Mac Horton, who won the silver and bronze, respectively. On the women's side, young American Katie Ledecky, who is just 18 and has already broken a world record in Kazan, took home the gold in the 200-meter freestyle. She shared the podium with silver medalist Federica Pellegrini of Italy and her teammate Missy Franklin, who won bronze. Finally, the mixed 4x100 medley relay finals finished with a bang as the British team of Chris Walker-Hebborn, Adam Peaty, Shobin Marie O'Connor, and Francesca Halsall combined to win the gold and to break the world record in the event that had been set by the U.S. just days earlier. The USA team finished second, a little over a second behind the Brits, while Germany seized the bronze. China remains at the top of the medal count with 31 total, including 14 golds. Host country Russia is far behind in second place with 15 medals, although they do have 9 golds, and the U.S. is right behind Russia with 8 golds, although the U.S. does have more medals overall with 19. Great Britain used its great day in the pool yesterday to move right up behind the U.S. for fourth place with 6 golds and 12 total medals. And that does it for the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Jonah Haskell. Back to Kim Lewis and Jahaeus Wuhib.
Okay, thank you, Jonah. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, we have an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, fistula patients in South Sudan shunned by their communities. And next, corruption pervasive throughout the asylum process in South Africa. But first, some music. Here is Idir and Nadia of Algiers with Amon Père.
Citoyenne, que je me lève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
Face à ton destin, n'oublie jamais que le respect sera toujours comme la racine de notre famille. Tu es ma fille.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, loin de sa terre. À mon père, qui sans lire et sans écrire a su faire de sa vie mon devenir.
C'est par toi que survit mon patrimoine, c'est par toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
Tu sais, bah, il y a des choses entre une fille et son père qui ne se disent pas chez nous. Mais une chose est sûre, c'est que tu m'as toujours dit de respecter les autres et de travailler dur, dur pour aller toujours plus loin, toujours plus haut. Et tu m'as rendue citoyenne du monde.
Parce que Ziram se veut d'être l'homme libre, tu porteras ce nom comme on porte le destin. C'est un peu de moi, même si je ne te le dis pas. Je suis entre tes mains comme l'eau sacrée d'un pays. Citoyenne de ce monde, ta vie sera ma vie.
Mon patrimoine, c'est par toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, loin de sa terre, qui sans lire et sans écrire a su faire de sa vie mon devenir.
C'est par toi que survit mon patrimoine, c'est par toi, citoyenne, que je m'élève, c'est pour toi que je t'ai. Mes sentiments par amour, pour ma foi et mon enfant.
À mon père, j'ai à dire tellement de choses. À mon père, cet homme libre, loin de sa terre. À mon père.
Idir and Nadia of Algiers with A Mon Père.
In South Sudan, doctors at Wild Teaching Hospital have begun operating on the first of 40 obstetric fistula patients. They were scheduled for surgery earlier but were delayed by the observance of Ramadan. Health officials say they hope more women will be admitted for surgery during this campaign. As Demo Silva reports from WOW, many women and girls suffer from the disabling condition and are shunned by their communities.
Obstetric fistula patients have been admitted at WOW Teaching Hospital waiting for Dr. Said Ahmed, a surgeon from Nigeria who specializes in fistula repair procedures, to begin his work. Isaac Kleto, Western Baal Ghazal State Minister of Health, says Dr. Ahmed will be assisted by two South Sudanese surgeons who will ensure that patients are closely monitored for a month before being discharged. Kleto says he has the utmost confidence in Dr. Ahmed.
The main surgeon is a Nigerian surgeon who is a very competent surgeon, and the outcome was excellent, and I'm sure you will have a chance even to interact with the past patients that are operated, because we are going to use them again. We do not lose contact with them. We are going to use them to mobilize.
Kleto says officials will use this opportunity to educate women about the importance of delivering their babies at a health facility to avoid the risk of developing obstetric fistula. The condition occurs when a hole develops in the reproductive organs during difficult or lengthy labor. He says the campaign also offers a platform for discussing the dangers of early marriage, one of the main causes of fistula in South Sudan. Fistula patients usually suffer urine leakage, which often results in social isolation, depression, and deepening poverty. Some women who have responded to the campaign say they have suffered from fistula for 20 years or more. Patricia Asikiwe from the International Medical Corps says this counseling offers students vital experience in handling difficult medical situations.
Almost all the students have not seen a fistula patient before, all of them, and have never managed a fistula condition before. So it is an eye-opener. It is good for them as midwives and nurses in training, so that when they qualify and they are posted to the communities, they have a case of obstructed labor and prolonged labor. They know that they do not need to be delayed.
One of the government's main health partners, the United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA, expects overwhelmingly positive results from the campaign. UNFPA program specialist Stephen Mauer says the campaign provides urgently needed medical and psychological care.
The fistula patients are people who are usually marginalized in society. They are poor, they can't afford health care and treatment. So with the partners that we're working with, like Women and Health Alliance, that's WAHA, and IMC, and also World Food Program, we joined hands together to carry out this campaign, and we are targeting 150 women to be treated and restore their dignity.
Dr. Edmond Sebit Wau, teaching hospital's medical director, says although the initial delay caused some logistical problems, those issues have since been worked out.
All the process from transportation of the patient from all the different sectors to the World Teaching Hospitals are free in charge. All the services here is free. From Awil, about 34. We receive 6 from Tonj and 3 from Rumbek. And the others here. Wow.
22-year-old Teresa Akur says she developed fistula in 2008 after delivering 3 children, all of whom died during childbirth. She says she has been living a close-off life ever since.
I have been staying in the house and could not interact with people. I hope after the operation I will be able to move outside to interact freely with people.
This is a third fistula campaign conducted in Western Baal Ghazal State. In 2012, 75 women were successfully operated on. Last year, another 80 underwent surgery. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio, reporting from WOW.
Corruption is pervasive in the asylum process in South Africa, says a report published this month. Almost a third of asylum seekers and refugees have to pay bribes for correct documentation, which violates the Refugees Act. The government's Home Affairs Department has recently been the focus of a cleanup campaign. Rights groups say incompetence within Home Affairs is contributing to the number of undocumented foreigners being targeted for investigation. Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg.
Asylum seekers and refugees experience significant corruption involving multiple actors, according to a report by Lawyers for Human Rights and the African Centre for Migration and Society. Refugee reception offices arbitrarily issue documents to asylum seekers and refugees looking to renew their documents, according to the report, which is based on interviews with over 900 applicants. Corruption is most pervasive at the refugee reception office in Marabastad, Pretoria, with over two-thirds of applicants experiencing it. If you cannot pay, rejection is almost guaranteed. Kabelo Zedapani from Corruption Watch, a non-profit platform for reporting corruption, said extortion methods are evolving.
Our undercover operations are revealing new types of corruption that we hadn't kind of taken notice of. And these include corruption such as people having to pay translators or translators putting prices on the type of stories that they can sell you. So the more money you have, the better your story. If you don't have any money, we're going to tell a fake story.
South Africa is one of the top global recipients of asylum seekers and received over 70,000 applicants in 2013, similar to the number in the European Union or United States. The large demand on the asylum system has allowed corruption to thrive, argues Laura Lando, researcher at ICMS.
So the argument here is that Home Affairs and the way in which it's dealing with immigrants and refugees is shifting from one that is based on law, based on policy, to one that is based on profit. If we're talking about reforming the asylum system, any kind of legal or policy reform is going to be ineffective if you're not going to be able to counter the deep-seated corruption and the logic of profit-making that has taken root here.
Corruption coupled with chaotic application processes increases the risk of asylum seekers remaining undocumented. If they are arrested, they could be sent back to the countries from which they fled. Gillian Parker, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mbunganyi, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Afghan Minister of Finance Ekhlil Hakimi, the U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan P. Michael McKinley, and the USAID Mission Director William Hemmink signed a Memorandum of Understanding for the New Development Partnership on August 3, 2015, in Kabul. The New Development Partnership reflects the strategic importance of the U.S.-Afghanistan relationship and recognizes a new era of development cooperation between our governments. This initiative delivers on the commitment made during Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's March visit to Washington, during which President Barack Obama pledged to support the Afghan National Unity Government's efforts to achieve its own ambitious reform agenda. Afghanistan's Minister of Finance Hakimi thanked the U.S. for its generous support with the New Development Partnership, under which the U.S. will provide up to $800 million to Afghanistan to maintain and build on the development gains made over the last 13 years. U.S. Ambassador P. Michael McKinley remarked that the New Development Partnership represents a fundamental transformation in the nature of development cooperation between our two countries. It empowers Afghan solutions to Afghan challenges by incentivizing and rewarding Afghan successes. Afghanistan continues to face difficult challenges: recovery from decades of violent conflict, the continuing threat of violent extremism, the need to provide education, health care, and basic infrastructure for millions of men, women, and children. In meeting these challenges, Afghanistan will have the continued help of its friend and ally, the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Mutima kasindu na makuru intira yambanye ndende mwonesa kurkwana ni mutima nagerageje kubifamo none nsanze mushaka this way oh Cause we come Doom the Catching Aurora